Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who thinks that the London series is maybe treason. I'm Jake Mintz, and that's Jordan Schusterman. And didn't we fight a war over this?
Yeah, it's weird to just head on back and then play baseball, but I like it. I don't know. To me, it's almost establishing victory. You know, we're not going back there to play rounders, and I feel like that's a big win.
Great point.
We are going to talk about the London series on this here podcast. That'll be after the break. We are going to begin the first half of this show drafting the biggest surprises of the first half. I know we're not quite at the All-Star break, but
boo,
we are almost
boo, boo.
At the... Oh, whoa, boo. Oh, Jake, he surprised me. He stunned me. This is really the middle of the season. You know, we treat the All-Star break like it is a half. That has never basically ever been the case. And so since we are arriving at the 80-game mark, we figured this would be a good time to draft five surprises each. Later on, we'll talk about the London series. Wander Franco has been benched. He is in timeout. We are going to review the MLB draft combine in whatever weird form it currently exists. We are going to preview the first showdown between our two favorite teams, the Mariners and the Orioles, before finishing, as always, with the good, the bad, and the ugly. But Jake, before we begin our draft, what inspired you to do this as a form to recap the first half of the season? And are there any parameters for this draft?
There are none. We enter every season with expectations about players, about teams, about the league itself. And every year, those expectations, some of them are shattered and they are reformed. And I think it is important to revisit why and when our expectations were wrong so that in the future, maybe our expectations and our predictions are a little bit better. And so today we will each pick the five most surprising things from the first half of the season. It can be a trend. It can be a player. It could be a team. Most of mine are teams and players, but you can really go anywhere with this wherever you want. Cool. You want the first pick?
Sure. I'll take pick.
You had a worse 2022 than I did, so you take the first pick.
Sure. Yeah. I don't. I feel like we've done drafts before where you've said the exact opposite, but that's fine. I will take the first pick. And I am going to listen. I mean, there's very simple ways to do this. Who had the highest expectations and who is in the worst position? And I'm going to go with something that I actually just tweeted and I'm still marveling at it. And it is the combination of the Pirates and the Cardinals first half of the season. For the Pirates to now have two multiple stretches of being one of the three worst teams in baseball and to still be so many games ahead of the St. Louis Cardinals, who have not been that injured, I'm going to combine that into this too, where the Cardinals have basically had the players that they expected to have and it has not mattered. They suck so much. And while the Cardinals were not necessarily projected to be as good as some other teams that we might be talking about in this draft, I think that combined with how the rest of the NL Central has gone, which maybe that will be a separate pick, is still stunning to me. Mathematically, looking at how bad the Pirates have been in May and now during this epic losing streak, and it just doesn't matter. None of it computes, and it continues to stun me every time I open the standings. The Cardinals being this bad and the Pirates also being this bad and so far ahead of the Cardinals are my first pick.
Great pick, Jordan. I had on my board the complete capitulation of the Cardinals' way, which I think is too similar to what you picked. So I'm actually going to cross that off my board.
Got it.
My first pick is Bryce Harper. Mm. Bryce Harper had his elbow redone in November of 2022. And we were not expecting to see Bryce Harper until like now, right? Right before the All-Star break, maybe even after it. And instead, Bryce Harper came roaring back, a medical marvel, and debuted in early May against all odds. Maybe we never should have doubted the man who has wowed us for the better part of a decade, but we did because we trust medicine. But Bryce Harper said, take your medicine up your pipe and shove it. I'm going to come back. Tommy John or no Tommy John. And he has been Bryce Harper since he got back, more or less. Maybe not as, you know, incredible as you'd hope, but 124 OPS plus for a guy who had his elbow rewired less than a year ago. Tip my cap to Bryce. Like, did you really think he was going to be back? Like, did you think he was going to be back at this point? No, like, that's a surprise. No.
Right. How he's even doing is almost secondary. So I think that's a great one. I think and that's related to, I think, my second pick in a slightly different way. And I almost could have ended up lumping these together. It's also a theme I've kind of watched, and that is the return of a superstar and in some ways the lack of boost that it has given the San Diego Padres. Because Jake, I don't know if you've been paying attention to Fernando Tatis Jr. Over the last month, but he has looked like the best player in baseball in June, and it has not really mattered all that much for the Padres. I know they just avoided the mop against the Giants, but I am taking the combination of Fernando Tatis Jr. looking like Fernando Tatis Jr. since he's come back, and the Padres still being multiple games under 500. And when you look at the projections too, I mean, maybe we'll talk about the Mets at some point in this segment, but the Padres were the team that, even with the lack of depth, if they were healthy, and I know they've dealt with some Machado injuries, I just thought this team would be great. And they're just not great. They're not even good. And I cannot quite wrap my mind around that. So that is going to be my second pick, is Tatis doing what you could have possibly hoped and it not mattering that much.
I'm going to take a Tatis-related thing as well. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take his incredible outfield defense.
Mm. See, this doesn't this much of a surprise, but it is a good pick and worthy of talking about on a podcast. So go ahead.
He is in the 95th percentile of outs above average in right field. Even if you thought Fernando Tatis Jr. would eventually adjust to the outfield, I don't think any of us expected him to figure it out to this extent this quickly. Yes, he is an outrageous athlete, but there is, you know, tracking balls in the outfield is not simple. We saw Jazz Chisholm early in the season in center field, who was a career infielder moving to the outfield, look incredibly stupid on a number of plays. And I understand that Jazz's numbers are actually a little bit better than that, whatever. But Tatis has just looked like a great outfielder the entire time. And even more than that, his arm in the outfield is more entertaining than his arm at shortstop somehow. So I'm going to take Fernando Tatis Jr. being in the outfield. I actually have another Tatis thing on my board that I'm just going to say because neither of us are going to draft another one. Mm-hmm. And that is him not being booed that much.
Mm. That has surprised you.
We have gotten the, like, he's a cheater or steroids chance where he's dancing along. But I feel like we haven't seen any video of that in like a month now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we've moved past it again. It's like when the Padres are such a mess, fans are less even focused on, like, there was a version where the Padres were in first and he was tearing it up and they were now this new, not villain, because they're not necessarily as hateable as these other teams, but he could have been the face of a team that was beating other people's asses, and it's not happening. And so it's just like, oh yeah, Tatis, you're back. Your team still sucks. Sucks for you. That's a good one. I'm going to take another NOS thing, and that is that, and I'm going to take advantage of the fact that this might not be true for that much longer. But Jake Mintz, it's June 23rd, and the Giants and D-backs are ahead of both the Dodgers and Padres. This maybe even should have been the first pick, I would say, because when you consider the strength that we viewed of the relative NL Central and the Cardinals and how skeptical we were of the pitching, this is like just, I don't even know what you could have told me would have needed to happen for this to both be true. It's one thing to have the D-backs off to a hot start, but I'm still trying to kind of wrap my mind around it. And what's fun about it too is it's like, I don't even feel like we'd fully processed the D-backs by the time the Giants won 9 in a row or whatever. And so now I'm caught between trying to solve both of these teams and what the hell's going on here. It's fun. It's going to make the rest of the season very interesting. But I'm compelled now, as far as the NL postseason picture, we've been so focused on, oh my God, could the NL East get 3-4 teams in? We're clearly looking in the wrong place and at the wrong coast. So that's something I'm fascinated by the rest of the season.
That's just East Coast bias, bro.
Clearly was. I feel horribly wrong about that. So that is definitely qualifies as a surprise.
I'm going to take Zach Neto.
Okay.
Who is Zach Neto, Jordan? Zach Neto was a first-round pick in 2022, 13th overall, by the Los Angeles of Anaheim. They took him out of Campbell University. He's a shortstop. He has a leg kick the size of the Eiffel Tower. He's a pretty good defensive shortstop. Zach Neto has already posted a 111 OPS plus in the big leagues this season. For anybody, let alone a guy with an incredibly complicated leg kick, to go from drafted in July of 22 to above average hitter as a shortstop, as a 22-year-old in the big leagues less than a year later, is remarkable. We had gotten good reviews on Neto after he got into pro ball, but I don't think we anticipated him being up now, and we definitely did not anticipate him hitting this well now. And even after they called him up, it was like, oh, maybe he can inject a little bit of life and give them some stability defensively at shortstop. And he's been an above average hitter, which is remarkable and incredibly impressive.
That's a great pick. Yeah, I had a couple rookie related things on here, and maybe I'll pick one just because I feel like we haven't talked about him enough, and I'll just combine it with something else. I'm going to go with the combination of Yuri Perez already being one of the best pitchers in the league and Sandy Alcantara not even close to being one of the best pitchers in the league. And it may be in combination how this Marlins season has succeeded in this form. Because so much of what we expected about them as they currently sit 10 games over 500 and in second place in the NL East was like, all right, well, they're not going to, like, hopefully a rise is good and you have some bounce back. And that's obviously happened. But we were expecting huge strides forward from this pitching staff. And Perez was sort of part of that conversation, but not necessarily who we would be relying on. And yet here we are, and Lizardo's been decent, and Braxton Garrett's been pretty good, but Sandy still has an ERA over 5, halfway through the season. And the bullpen's, like, pretty good. It's okay. And it's Yuri Perez. Yuri Perez has come up. He's born in 2003, and he's got a 1.54 ERA through 8 starts. He's unbelievable. I don't think we're talking about him nearly enough, but I think the Marlins in general certainly deserve representation in this draft, and there are a lot of things going on with that team, which is both Sandy being bad and Jazz being a non-factor that I think belong in this conversation.
Right. I think I'm not going to draft this, but Luis Arraez tickling 400. Anybody tickling 400 deserves to be mentioned.
This is a surprise, yes.
It is certainly a surprise. I'm going to take Alek Manoah now.
Yeah, has to be.
Unfortunately. Manoah was one of the best pitchers in the world last year. He finished third in the AL Cy Young. He finished 17th in the MVP voting ahead of Alex Bregman and Yandy Diaz and Dylan Cease. I believe he finished second in the AL Cy Young amongst pitchers, if you don't count Shohei Ohtani. 196 innings last year with a 2.24 ERA, 180 strikeouts. And this year, my man just drove off a cliff. 58 innings pitched, 6.36 ERA, leading the league in walks. Still, I think he hasn't pitched in like 3 weeks, and I believe
that's true.
Still leading the league in walks. There is black ink on his baseball reference page.
Oh, just no. Check this. That's not a good sign.
That's not what you want.
Let's see. He's still technically tied for the AL lead in walks. Jack Flaherty has passed him. But yeah, tied with Kopech, and he's not pitched in, three weeks now. that kind of tells you all you need to know. That's why he's down in Florida, presumably figuring his shit out. That's a great one. Probably should have been one of the first picks. I'm going to go on the offensive side for mine and do Jose Abreu. Jose Abreu and the non-Yordan Astros offense. Because I looked at this group and we said, oh my God, like this feels like overkill, right? When you consider, and even knowing Altuve was out to start the year, and Altuve has been pretty good since he got back. But Jose Abreu being bad to this degree, and it looked like he was turning a corner a couple weeks ago, but now he's back in like a 2-for-20 stretch. Him combined with Bregman, combined with Kyle Tucker being worse, combined with Pena regressing, not shocking. It's just not a good lineup. It's just like straight up not a good lineup. And it looks especially bad in contrast to the Rangers who they're chasing. But the Abreu struggling to this degree and the Astros offense just not at all being remotely intimidating is a very new feeling. And when Jordan comes back, whenever that is, that will change at least to some degree. But it is not anywhere close to what I thought this lineup was going to be at all. And it might end up costing them. Like they can't coast into the postseason the way they could in years past with a good offense and a great pitching staff. And we'll see if that actually costs them a spot in the postseason.
It is bizarre, right? Because when your favorite team is playing the Astros and you see them on the schedule, there's an element of fear and reverence that bubbles up inside your chest. And then when the game starts and they flash the lineup graphic on screen and you're like, ah, shit, we got to face these guys and that guy and this guy. And this guy's going to hit two balls into the Crawford boxes and that guy's going to hit one into right field. And you're just worried. You don't worry right now, especially with Jordan out of the lineup. They are not a formidable group. And it is a bizarre feeling to see people in that uniform and think, oh, this pitcher can take care of that.
Yeah, it is. It is very, very, very strange. But hey, not complaining. Okay. I think you have one more pick.
I do. I'm going to ask, this is how all drafts work. You ask your opponents who they're going to take so that you can take someone different. Are you going to take a Reds related thing with your last pick or no?
No. I should, but I feel like we've talked about the Reds so much. I've grown used to it, so it is not surprising me anymore.
I am going to take a Reds thing then.
Okay.
Besides the Cincinnati Reds surprising everybody with how good they've been, I am going to take Ellie De La Cruz, but specifically, I am going to take the extent to which Ellie De La Cruz is faster than everyone else in the league. He is not just fast or really fast or the fastest. He is the fastest player in the league by half a foot per second. To put that into context, he is at 30.9 feet per second. Bobby Witt Jr. is second at 30.4. And there are only 8 players above 30. He is so much faster than anybody else we've ever seen. Corbin Carroll, who has made all these highlights, right, is almost a full foot per second behind Ellie De La Cruz.
He said it himself. He's the fastest man in the world. Forget the league. He's self-proclaimed fastest man in the world, which he said post-game, I believe, in Kansas City. But I've been meaning to say, I heard him say that before his debut. I remember watching him sit in the dugout with Jonathan India and Matt McClain. And India was kind of ribbing both of them like, oh, who's faster? Who's this? Because all of them know that McClain and him are tight. And Ellie said, he asked him, like, oh, are you faster than McClain? He's like, faster than McClain? Like, I'm the fastest man in the world. Like, I heard him say that. So I'm glad that that also made it to the public space. Yeah, it's a great one. That's a great one. There's a lot of things that are shocking about Ellie De La Cruz. Not that he's talented and good and productive, but like viscerally watching it, there are some shocking things. And so I think that's a good pick.
If you go to the sprint speed leaderboard on Baseball Savant, you just see his dot stand out from the pack in a very incredible way. He is not the fastest man in the world, but he's certainly the fastest man in baseball.
Yeah, that's a great one. Okay, my last one, I think, is going to be the Minnesota Twins having an elite pitching staff and an absolute dog shit offense. And I know there's still in first place, and I know Byron Buxton just hit 2 very long home runs. The Byron Buxton situation probably deserves some attention as he is physically unable to play the outfield, but very physically able to hit balls 460 feet multiple times in one game.
It's a rare disorder, Jordan. It's like an episode of House. Sir, doctor, I'm able to do this, but not this. What do I have? Oh, you have Buxtonia.
But this is so backwards from the Twins teams that we have seen succeed in recent history, like the Bomba Squad. All year, they've had really a top 3 pitching staff alongside Tampa Bay and Houston. It's, you know, gotten a little bad, but after the Joe Ryan performance yesterday, he's been sensational. I think he's been even better than Sonny Gray. But him and Sonny Gray and Pablo Lopez, I know the ERA is up, but the FIP is still way down. And Bailey Ober has been back to awesome. And the bullpen with Duran, like, The Twins turning that into their strength also in the year after Wes Johnson left is great. That also, it makes it very, very funny to me. And yeah, there's obviously a lot with the AL Central. But I actually don't know how much of that is really that surprising. But that part of the Twins, I have to acknowledge for my last pick, or maybe we took too many picks.
No, we each took the right amount of picks. Just other things that were on my board. that I want to mention, Kenley Jansen. Heading into the year, there was a big narrative around how would the pitchers who take too long adjust to the pitch clock. And we were worried about Kenley Jansen specifically, and he's been better, and his velocity is up 2 ticks. You know, it's like, okay, sure. Like, I'm shocked by that. Not just that he's been fine, that he's adjusted to it, but that he's been like a better version of himself. That's been very surprising to me.
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, I, you know, which Rays hitter? I thought about taking Taylor Walls, except he's kind of gone in the toilet offensively recently, but like his first month or so was completely incomprehensible. There are a few other offensive performances that are probably worthy of discussion.
I don't know. Siri.
Yeah, again, Rayleigh, whatever. On the negative side, like Trey Turner just sucking. Like that one, especially, you know, coming out of the WBC, that one certainly would qualify as a surprise in the disappointing category. Certainly some Phillies things that I think definitely fit, but we'll cut it there. If we forgot any obvious ones, there are some other standings related ones that certainly deserve attention, but I think this was a fun kind of general summary of what has shocked us the most in the early going. Anything, final thoughts on that before we take a break, Jake Mintz?
No.
Let's do it. We are going to take a quick break, and when we return, we will preview the London series between the Cubs and the Cardinals and do other fun baseball podcasting things, because that is our job.
This is former PGA Tour winner Smiley Kaufman, host of The Smiley Show, a SiriusXM podcast. You want to know what I love about golf? I get to talk to some really cool people. I get to walk the fairways of the best courses in the world with the best players in the world, and I get to share it with you every single week. Listen to The Smiley Show right now on Stitcher, Pandora, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Smiley, S-M-Y-L-I-E.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And bruv in it, mate.
Indeed, sir. Bruv, we are ready to talk ball. Talk ball, Jake, because baseball will be being played in London Stadium this weekend on Saturday and Sunday. Two ball games, two matches, as they will say, in the neighboring neighborhoods between
fixtures.
The Cubs and the Cardinals.
Fixtures.
Oh, fixtures. Oh, that's great. That's a way better term. I like that. Yeah, fixtures. The Cubs and the Cardinals. Is this the marquee matchup that the league may have hoped for? At least the Cubs have a positive run differential. The 36 and 38 Cubs will play the 31 and 44 Cardinals. Let's review what happened the last time we had games in London, Jake, because this is the second time. We were supposed to have this matchup in 2020. I don't know if you saw, there was a pandemic, but now we're back. Cardinals and Cubs are going to get to play. But in 2019, we saw the Yankees and Red Sox hop across the pond and deliver one of the messier combinations, duos of baseball games that we have seen at the time. Now, I have to say, it probably didn't help that's peak juice ball, like just beyond juice ball, even relative to, you know, as people have conspired regarding the Field of Dreams game and stuff like that. Like, this was really when the ball was flying like absolute nuts. And when you combine that with the goofy dimensions of London Stadium, which most notably includes, I think, the most shallow center field wall of any game, major league game that you will see this year. Right and left field isn't like completely unrealistic, but center field is especially close. We had 17 to 13 and 12 to 8. That first game, teams combining for 37 hits. That second game, teams combining for 28 and, of course, 20 runs. What do you remember about those two games and kind of what it felt like watching those games?
I remember the first game, the 17 to 13 game. Because the Yankees go out there in the top of the first and they put up 6 runs on Rick Porcello. And we're like, man, Porcello just didn't have it today. Like, you know, jet lag, whatever. And then the Yankees go out of the field in the bottom of the first and Tanaka's out there. Mm-hmm. And the Red Sox put up 6 on him in the bottom of the first.
Remember him, by the way? He was awesome.
Oh, he was great. And it's 6-6 after one inning. And we're like, what the hell is going on over there?
It was. I mean, again, for those more recent comparison, for those that are, I mean, it was like the Mexico City situation, although it wasn't an elevation problem. My favorite thing about this box score is Nestor Cortez coming in and just wearing it before he was good. This is, I guess, the first Nestor stint, although technically, yeah, it's confusing because he then ends up on the Mariners in 2020. But yes, this is when he just is not, he's just not a good, not good. He's just not good. And he's coming in for mop-up work, gives up a couple homers. So many pitchers, but we had like 18 combined pitchers in this game. And then another 16 in the second game with Stephen Tarpley against Erod. It was just a total mess.
And I have to say, no notes, no feedback. Do the same thing again.
Run it
if
back.
If we're trying to grow the game in new places around the world, no one wants a pitching duel.
No.
Like, just give me ding-dongs.
Totally. And I think that this is exactly what the Cardinals' offense needs, arguably exactly what the Cubs' offense needs. And if we get that again with Goldie and Arenado and, you know, if, like, say, a Suzuki goes, like, that'll be great. Now, let's get to the obvious part. Well, this is not about what happens for these two teams, right? Well, what is the point of this in the first place?
Just one more thing about the 17-13 game. I just want you to hop inside the shoes of a British baseball fan, mm-hmm. or even just a British person living in London who got some tickets to go see this weird thing happening at the stadium, right? You show up and you get 17-13. You're drinking a couple beers, throwing down some pints, and every 2 minutes there's a home run and you get to be like, hey!
Here's the whole point of this. You're so right, except here's the thing about that game. It was 5 hours long. And now it won't be 5 hours long. And so I think that will help because I remember even with the fireworks, by the end it felt, especially because that first game, the Yankees put up a lot more to the point where it was 17-6. And so at that point, you're not necessarily enjoying the fixture. And so that I would say, well, I imagine the pitch clock will help. The second game, it was 4-2 through six, and then the Yankees put up a 9 spot in the top of the seventh with no homers, I believe, too. So this is all. I mean, also to be fair, like some bad pitchers pitching in these games. Like I know we mentioned Tanaka and whatever, but this was not exactly, you know, a who's who of like an all-star bullpen coming in to keep the game close.
We weren't sending our best.
No. No, we weren't, which is, you know, might also be true in this case with some of the pitching performances for Chicago and St. Louis. But to your point, what is the point? Why are these games existing? We love this, not because we specifically care about growing the game in England, although, of course, we do. We want the game to grow everywhere. We just want to see baseball games in interesting new places. And for that reason, I'm kind of bummed it's not in a different stadium, right? I wish this was in Wembley. I wish this was in, you know, at the Fulham Stadium with 200-foot fences. Like, I want to get weirder than just running back what we did in 2019, you know? Like, that part of me feels like we could get even goofier. But the point is, yes, you are intending to grow the sport. Is it ever going to be to the point where the people in London love the Jacksonville Jaguars? Probably not, but that's fine. It's still cool to see different games in different places, and I love it, and I'm excited to watch.
Congrats to you for dropping a Craven Cottage reference here on Baseball Barbercast.
If you thought I remembered it was called Craven Cottage, you're giving me too much credit. Anyway, London series. Let's cut it off here because they will probably give us plenty to talk about on Monday. So we're just going to punt that conversation to Monday.
One last thing, though. Coming off the heels of a great Great Britain showing in the WBC, I wonder if that increases
support. And I know there's some cries for the Cardinals to call up Matt Kupierniak, a British-born Cardinals prospect, who has been playing quite well in AAA, so maybe they can make that happen and get Team Britain some representation. All right, let's move on to someone who will not be playing baseball games in London or in America this weekend. Jake Wander Franco, the prodigal son, the greatest prospect before Victor Wembanyama. This man is not going to be playing baseball this weekend because of what Kevin Cash is referring to as quote, dealing with the challenges of being a major league player. I like this quote particularly because on the field, Wander has not really dealt with the challenges of being a major league player. He's 22 and he's one of the best players in baseball. He was on track to, you know, be in the MVP conversation if Shohei Ohtani didn't exist. But it seems like there's some issues off the field. What is your takeaway from this?
I trust Kevin Cash here. And I think as fans, it is understandable whenever a player is benched to have some skepticism about the reasons why, considering the history of baseball and how uncomfortable those in power, coaches and management, are with young players, particularly young Latino and Black players, expressing themselves. And, you know, a lot of the discourse around Acuna a couple years ago falls into this category a little bit for me. The reason that I trust Kevin Cash here is how he has handled other Wander Franco things so far this year. When Wander flipped the ball up to himself in the game and made every old person watching it lose their minds, Kevin Cash backed him up. He said, this doesn't matter. Wander's a great player. For him to be at his best, he needs to feel comfortable being himself on the field, and we support Wander, and I wish I was good enough to do that. And so what that tells me is that whatever these disciplinary things are behind the scenes have some weight to them, have some heft. And it is possible that like a 22-year-old kid is being immature and maybe not handling himself to the best, you know, to the highest extent. And he needs to understand that that's not okay. Now, does it hurt the Rays on the field for a couple of days? Yeah, sure. But like the Rays aren't stupid, right? This organization clearly knows what it's doing. And they have done, you know, whatever beep, bop, boop, bop cost benefit analysis of this situation. And they've determined that trying to teach Wander, who's going to be in their organization for the next decade, a lesson that he's going to maybe be able to grow from is a good thing.
Totally agree. It's hard not to look at it and say, would they do this if they weren't about to play the worst team in the league and were up by 5 games? Probably not, but it doesn't matter because to your point, like it's part of the calculus, right? They said we can show them a lesson. We can do this. And did it maybe end up costing them in a close loss to the worst team in baseball last night against Kansas City? Maybe. But I don't think they care that much. I think they are because to your point too, right? Like they've already invested in Wander big time and he is going to be in that. He's the guy. And so they need to do whatever they can to kind of keep that on the tracks. Obviously, it's not serious to the point where this needs to be a bigger deal than it is. So it's curious. It's interesting. I'm sure people want to make more of it than it is, but I'm with you. I trust that they're making the right decision. And if he's getting a little loose off the field, like that wouldn't shock me. And, you know, it's okay. It's not the end of the world.
There's a really difficult balance to achieve with your best players. And I think we were talking about this in regards to A-Rod, right? Alex Rodriguez is one of the most self-centered people we've ever interacted with. But of course he's self-centered. He hit 696 home runs. If I hit 696 home runs, I would have a very high opinion of myself too. Mm-hmm. And every superstar in baseball, every player in baseball to an extent, has a high opinion of themselves, has a lot of self-confidence to convince themselves they can succeed at this level, right? Mm-hmm. Now balancing that with being a schmuck around your coworkers is a difficult thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it is clear that in this situation, the scales tipped a little bit.
And by the way, you know, as he sort of vaguely alluded to, we don't know exactly what happened, but he is in some ways referring to Wander not dealing with struggling on the field and picking that off the field. It's hard not to notice that he struck out 3 times on Wednesday, which he never, ever, ever does, right? Like, it's quite possible that Wander Franco, in his rare moments of failure on a baseball field, which he has had very few of since he was like 11, is not dealing with it in the most mature way, in the way that we do see other players also have issues with. So it's interesting. I think it would, like you said, I trust the Rays here. Wander will be back. He'll be one of the best players in baseball. Not too worried about it, but we did want to address it.
And I trust that he'll mature.
Yeah.
I don't think this is that big of a deal either because we were idiots when we were 22. Mm-hmm. And we would have been even bigger idiots when we were 22 if the world was freaking out about how good we were at a sport and I had just been given $200 million.
Yes.
This is par for the course. You know,
yep.
Bryce Harper was a schmuck at 22. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't the best teammate in the world and he grew up and he learned from it. I think it's important to remember that. Like where Wander is right now in his development as a player and a person, he's fine.
Yep. Yep, yep, yep. All good. All right. A couple more topics before we get to Good, Bad, Ugla. Quickly wanted to touch on the MLB Draft Combine, which I guess is technically still taking place right now. Although the televised scouted portion, I believe, has concluded. This is the third time the MLB has put on the MLB. Oh, my God. That's not what I meant. I apologize. Ooh. Please. I don't know if we need that to be edited out, but it is my Ooh. Least favorite thing in the world. I got caught up. I just wanted to make very clear. No, I wasn't sure if I was about to say the MLB Draft Combine or MLB has. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. Okay. Anyway. MLB has been putting this on for 3 years now, and the point of it is whatever. You know what a draft combine is, I assume, if you're listening to this. But the main purpose is to kind of, in the way that MLB has done in a lot of ways, for better or for worse, is consolidating and making the one of the processes of baseball more efficient and useful for teams. And there's some things that are bad about that, and there's also some things that are undeniably good about that. And in this case, it is getting a lot of the best amateur players in one place for a week to not just take BP and take infield and throw as hard as they can from the outfield and whatever. It's to actually meet with the teams. And that's really the main thing you need to know is if you've turned on the combine and you've said, this is not the most enthralling television ever, all the important things are happening in the suites where players get to actually go sit face to face, not on Zoom or not in random situations around their high school, and they can say, or college, and they can actually be asked the exact questions by the teams that are looking to get to know them. And like, that is just a huge part of this process. And while it is cool to watch, you know, 18-year-olds hit balls 450 feet in big league stadiums, and on a, you know, Wednesday afternoon, the important things going on here are mostly happening behind closed doors.
Can we televise that part?
Yeah, yes, please. That would be so much more interesting. Of course, they're doing interviews on network too, but it's cool. I mean, you know, I love the draft and it is helpful. Like I watch it just to kind of see the physicality and see the swings on some of these kids, especially for the high schoolers, because, you know, college, we're used to it. We watch them every weekend, but the high school kids, even now in 2023, most of the footage you're getting from them, especially in the spring, is through a chain link fence from some parent's cell phone, you know? And so that it's nice to be able to see them on MLB Network just taking hacks. Like that is helpful and cool for someone who is a draft dork like me.
Jordan, big weekend coming up as our two favorite teams, the Seattle Mariners and the Baltimore Orioles, will be facing off in a 3-game set in Baltimore at Camden Yards. The Mariners at 36 and 37. The Orioles at 45 and 28. Oh, baby. 9 games up. I guess 10 games up. Yikes.
Oh, that way ahead. Yeah, that's tough. No shock there. So this is the first time they will be playing. And now I certainly feel better than I did this time yesterday. But the Mariners have been, I believe them in Cleveland are the only teams who have not had a 5-game winning streak or losing streak. And I think that kind of summarizes where they're at. They just cannot get hot, but they are too good to go too cold, if that makes sense. Like, they're always liable to have a game like they had yesterday in New York, but they cannot draw any amount of consistency whatsoever, particularly on offense. And it's maddening. It is one of the more frustrating teams to watch for sure. Would I put them in a surprise? No, because a lot of the projection systems had them as an 82-83 win team. And that's kind of what they're headed for. So it sucks. I'm super happy for the Orioles. And I think this could still be a competitive series for sure. But it's, you know, that's kind of where I'm at mentally with the Mariners.
So I was around the Mariners the last 2 days at Yankee Stadium and the vibes are bad.
Yeah.
Just zipless. There's no bubbles in the soda, Jordan.
Yeah, it's weird. A lot of people, and I don't know, I know he was around the team vaguely, but there is a general sense that the team goes as JP Crawford goes, and he's currently injured and just like in a weird place. So that maybe has something to do with it. But yeah, I mean, well, who am I to tell you that you're wrong? Like, that's how the plays looked on the field. It's nice to get some verification in person. Let's take the opportunity now. I mean, of course, we're looking forward to Mariners Orioles, but any other series this weekend before we do Good, Bad, Ugly? I know we normally do this at the end of the Friday episode, but or the other ones before we finish with GBU?
Good question.
So I'm going to Cincinnati today, where the Braves, who haven't lost in over a week, and the Reds, who haven't lost in over 2 weeks, will be facing off A.J. Smith-Shawver against Luke Weaver. A.J. Smith-Shawver, born after Joey Votto was drafted, so prepare for that fun fact to show up on the broadcast tonight and or be tweeted at CespedesBBQ. So prepare for that, but that's certainly a series. I might be going to multiple games, probably just one. So Braves-Reds, obviously, top of the list for me.
Rangers-Yankees will be fun here in New York. Dodgers-Astros, showdown of underwhelming juggernauts. And then Diamondbacks-Giants, showdown of overwhelming minnows.
I mean, that's, yeah. I think D-backs-Giants, we just mentioned, I mean, they're both at the top of the division. Are the Giants close enough? They are 3.5 back. So I guess if they, you know, swept them, now we're really having a conversation. But D-backs have a nice little cushion there. But yeah, I mean, that's big time. That is no joke. Those will be very fun. All right, Jake Mintz, let's finish up with the good, the bad, the ugly. Why don't you start us off? Something good, something bad, something ugly. We do not have anything specifically Dan Ugla this week, as we did with Chelsea Janes. That story was amazing, but the party rolls on. Start us off with something good.
Blake Snell.
You stole it. I was going to do Blake Snell. Go ahead.
I have a love-hate relationship with Blake Snell because I love looking at his pitching lines when he's good, and I hate watching him pitch. I really, even when he's good, I dislike Blake Snell from a visual experience. Nothing against him. He seems like a perfectly regular individual. But over the last six starts, he has been electric with 2 earned runs in 36 innings, 56 punch outs. When Blake Snell gets hot and on a roll, no one can touch him. It is a reminder why he won a Cy Young. It is a reminder why he could still be one of the best 10 pitchers in the world at any given time, and why he still might get paid this offseason a little bit as he hits free agency. So I guess I'm happy he's had a strong stretch, even though my disdain for watching him visually remains.
Totally fair. I am going to go with the 2021 Atlanta Braves postseason squad, because you know Jorge Soler is back and you know that Jock Peterson is on fire. But did you know that Eddie Rosario has a 1226 OPS in June with 8 home runs? This is not something I was aware of. This man looked about as unimpactful as you could imagine with the Braves. Certainly last year when he was dreadful, and then the beginning of this year when it didn't look like it was getting any better. But he is the kind of hitter that can certainly heat up, as we saw in the postseason, and he has been amazing for Atlanta recently. And so I'm going to give him some love, and I wouldn't be surprised if he homers this weekend.
The sword-swinging bench maniac that is Guillermo Heredia has a .340 batting average in Korea right now.
Yes. He has, I think, 10 homers. He's one of the best hitters. I can't remember what team he's on. Is he on SSG? Is he on the Landers? He be Landon? Yeah, that's a good one. So yeah, shout out to that. I mean, Rosario, it was like, they brought him back. I was like, all right, really? Like, that's the one you're going to go with? He was so bad last year. And here he is. He's already been worthwhile this season to be that good for that amount of time. All right, what's bad, Jake?
Vinny Pasquantino getting surgery is bad.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Friend of the show, Vinny P, tore labrum in his right shoulder. Now, here's a funny story that's also bad. So Vinny, the news comes out. I'm going to out myself here, Jordan. This is me being
this
bad.
Is a worthy outing considering the... Yes, go ahead.
So it gets announced on Twitter that Vinny Pasquantino is getting surgery on his right shoulder. We are friends with Vinny. I text Vinny, love you, man. if you need anything, let me know. I know that Vinny had never had a major surgery. I had had a major surgery. If you need any advice or help, whatever, like I wanted to be a resource for him. He responded. We were texting a bit. And then I sent him a picture of his Baseball Savant arm strength rating, which, by the way, is first percentile. Like, Vinny this year has had...
You mean worst percentile.
The worst percentile. Like, no one in the big leagues has showed off a worse throwing arm than Vinny this year. And so I sent him a picture of that and said, at least now you have an excuse for this, for his bad arm strength. Now, here's what Jake Mintz, the idiot, did not realize, is that the surgery he's getting is on his non-throwing arm.
Oops.
And so Vinny responds, wrong arm, man. Can you imagine this poor guy's sitting there? His season's over. He gets a text from some stupid podcaster just fucking dunking on him and his poo-poo throwing arm. So funny. I feel bad about it. So that's bad.
Yeah, that right shoulder surgery is not going to help his left arm throwing strength. So good. So good. Fortunately for you, he's the only person, arguably, who you could make that joke with, survive, get away with it, and still want to tell the story while both being embarrassed and laugh about it. We love you.
That is true. Vinny and I are cool. He called me when he was high on happy pills after his surgery, Jordan.
Things are fine, is the point.
It was a very funny phone call. He was like, because I tweeted the picture of him pre-surgery, and he just goes, who is that? You or Jordan? Like, it was me.
It was you. Vinny, we love you. I wouldn't be surprised if Vinny makes an appearance on this show at some point during his rehab. All right. My bad this week is Giancarlo Stanton. Jake Mintz. If you recall, before he went on the IL on the second week of April, we were like, holy shit. This dude, like, we have unfortunately, stupidly forgotten how amazing this guy can be. Once again, he goes on the IL on April 16th. He is extremely upset about it, understandably. He's like, oh my God, I can't stay on the field. This sucks. I'm letting me down my team, blah, 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 blah. He comes back on June 2nd and homers in Dodger Stadium. And we're like, oh shit, here we go. Giancarlo, Aaron Judge isn't hurt. All is well. Then next day, Aaron Judge gets hurt. Since then, June 4th, Giancarlo Stanton is hitting 0-89 with one home run and like a 40% strikeout rate. He is 4-45 since June 4th, since Aaron Judge went out. That's not going to cut it if the other big man is on the shelf. It's not breaking news here, but when we talk about what the Yankees offense is and isn't with Aaron Judge away, Giancarlo Stanton is a huge part of that. And right now, he is a huge part of the problem. So Giancarlo Stanton has been bad. Is he capable of going, insano mode in the next month? Absolutely. But right now, he has been bad.
That is bad.
What's your ugla?
Jesse Winker and Colton Wong.
That's a good one.
Jesse Winker and Colton Wong were traded for one another over the offseason. Winker going from Seattle to Milwaukee and Wong going the other way from the Brewers to the Mariners. Both of them have absolutely freaking sucked. The awesome rare trade in which everyone loses and nobody wins. Wong has an OPS plus of 38 and Winker of 59. So I guess he's been almost twice as good as Wong, if you want to define it that way. The headline here is that before this week, neither of them had homered, which is remarkable. Then Jesse Winker homered on June 20th. Somehow, in Colton Wong's bones, he felt like a voodoo doll buzz and was like, I got a homer now too. And so Colton Wong hit his first homer of the year on June 22nd, last night against the New York Yankees. Just the odds of this, right? Like, what are the odds that this happens like 2 days apart? Both of these guys suck, traded for one another.
Let me add to this. What are the odds that Abraham Toro, who was also in that trade, would have homered before both of them in only 8 at-bats in the big leagues? And his wasn't that long ago either. His was at the end of May. Yeah, it's a great one. It's been one of the biggest mysteries of the Mariners and Brewers seasons, I would say. It was like both teams were like, we really believe we're getting a good bounce back, blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, nope, they both suck. So I know injuries have contributed to some degree, but yikes. Jake, my ugla this week before we go and I have to leave in 3 minutes, is Jack Sawinski. Oh, Jack Sawinski. Jake, what do you know about Jack Sawinski?
He's from Chicago.
Okay.
He swings really hard and hits a lot of home runs.
Okay, nice combination there. If you swing really hard and hit a lot of home runs, what are you probably good at?
You hit the ball hard.
Well, say that again, hitting the ball hard?
Yeah.
Close. What direction are you probably normally hitting the ball?
Up in the air.
Up in the air. Jack Sawinski, as things stand, currently has the second lowest ground ball rate of any hitter in the last 20 years. So, and the fun thing about this is just the bottom of this list. We only have a ball in play data, at least on Fangraphs, back to 2001, I believe. So it's possible I could look this up farther back. But Jack Sawinski currently running a 22.8% ground ball rate, joining three players who are, this is the bottom of the list, okay? Lowest ground ball rate. Frank Thomas, 2002. Frank Thomas, 2006. Frank Thomas, 2003. You wonder how the Big Hurts hit so many home runs. And then Mike Trout, 2019. Mike Trout, 2020. Rafael Palmeiro, 2002. Brandon Belt, Matt Carpenter, Joey Gallo. It's a great list, but Jack Sawinski's currently at the bottom, and I love that.
The Caucasian Frank Thomas.
That's what they call him. That's going to do it for this episode of Baseball Barbacast. This has been a treat as always. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for joining me. Thank you, Layla Patel, for producing. Chris Tyler will be back next week. But thank you, Jake Mintz. Any final words before we say goodbye? And say have a good weekend.
Cacophony.
Good word. See you on Monday. Bye.
SiriusXM Podcasts.